Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. And how's it going out there, Bitcoiners? Wherever you are in the world today, it's another beautiful day at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. I've got a great conversation with Jeremy Welch, founder and CEO of Casa, for you all today. But before we dive into this great one, I've got a word from our sponsor of this episode. Give Bitcoin is creating a clever new way to turn your pre-coiner friends and family into well-educated hodlers. You can give them time-locked Bitcoin. It's time-locked for at least 1 year, up to 5 years. And your hodler-to-be friend will receive month-by-month for that first year a world-class Bitcoin education. I'll be giving Bitcoin and that world-class education to friends and family using Give Bitcoin this Christmas, and I encourage you to do the same. I think it's the ultimate gift that keeps on giving, and unlike most holiday gifts, it certainly will not be forgotten a decade from now. You'll, in fact, be an absolute hero. Give Bitcoin has solved the pre-coiner to Bitcoiner equation. It's give plus time lock plus educate equals Bitcoiner. The beta was officially launched last week. You can find it at beta.givebitcoin.io. So check out Give Bitcoin right now and start minting new hodlers in your life. All right, let's go. Jeremy Welch is founder and CEO of Casa, a Bitcoin company making security and self-sovereignty accessible to everyone. In this episode, Jeremy and I discuss the founding and building of Casa. We get into the details of Casa products like the Keymaster, Seedless Multisig, the Casa node, and their new Bitcoin inheritance product, Covenant. We also discuss the Lightning Network, security, privacy, and a Bitcoin future. I enjoyed this conversation with Jeremy immensely. Hope you all enjoy it as well. Let's dive into this one. All right, I am super excited to welcome Jeremy Welch, founder and CEO of Casa, one of the best Bitcoin companies out there. Jeremy, welcome, man. How's it going?
Going well. Thanks for having me on, Brady.
You know, my listeners definitely know at this point that I'm an enthusiastic Casa customer. I mentioned Casa a lot on the podcast. My Casa One node was in the first batch that was delivered out about a year ago now.
Amazing.
Yeah, it came with the gold 2 of 3 seedless multisig, which is, you know, 10x better than any multisig experience that came before it for sure. You've added Tor support, Sats app. You've announced the Casa node 2. You guys have just been putting out like an impressive output of, you know, high level product over the past year. I'm sure it's been a bit of a blur for you, but like, how's, you know, your experience been the past year, kind of putting all this stuff out at Casa?
It's been great. You know, I'm extremely lucky to be able to work with and learn from not only some of the smartest people kind of in the Bitcoin space, but just like smartest people in the world. You know, it's always, it's one thing to be able to kind of pursue passion projects and pursue something that's already an interesting project. It's another thing to be able to just work with amazing people, period, on anything. And so I've been very lucky. It's been a lot of work. It's been a lot of stress, a lot of travel. I think I did over 175,000 miles, just like crazy amounts of travel. It was a lot of different cities. And because we have customers all over the world now, and then we have our team is fully distributed. And so because of that, it's a lot of work, but we've been very, very happy with the output and with the customer. I think the most rewarding thing, I think that people don't realize how the thing that keeps us going is knowing that our customers are enthusiastic and excited and, you know, love the products and give us that feedback, right? Like that's what makes it worth it. It's been a great year though.
So what is your professional background? Is Casa the first company you founded?
Casa is not the first company I founded. I've been building companies now for over a decade and in a variety of different roles, but I've founded a few companies. If we go back about right out a decade, I was actually pretty heavily in the ad tech industry. I had dropped out of school, and I went to Duke and I studied political philosophy there. I am technical. I grew up programming and I worked at an ISP in high school, but I specifically ended up studying political philosophy and kind of systems theory. And I'm really, really interested in cybernetics. And it's kind of a product view on the world, but like, you know, you have these systems and if you change like one piece, like if you insert Bitcoin into the system, right? Like what happens? And so I've taken a lens or taken a view towards thinking in those terms. But, you know, steering back to this question of companies, I left school because I just wasn't as engaged as, and I got kind of addicted to startups. And I joined this company called Invite Media. We were building a demand side platform, which is for advertising, which you can think of as a Bloomberg terminal, or just kind of almost like E-Trade. It just makes it really easy to buy ads.
Sure, sure.
And we sold that into large advertising agencies. And then we sold that company to Google in 2010. I was an early employee. I wasn't a founder there, but I learned a lot from the founders. I worked closely with them. And I was a forward deployed engineer there and then worked on some product stuff around data sales. So I was inside the belly of the beast, right? Like I saw a ton about how the data sales worked, how data collection works, how everything worked at Google. And then left after a year. I went back and finished up school. It was around that time that I found Bitcoin, and then did a series of projects after that that led up to creating Casa. And created Casa, again, I'd seen the kind of cycle of raising money and dealing with investors and building product and building teams. Casa was specifically a problem that I had and that I was concerned about long-term custody. I think there's still a bunch of massive opportunities in terms of new architectures of building new types of apps. We don't believe that Bitcoin is only a financial revolution. We in kind of a civilization level revolution, if you think of like capitalism as this lower level operating system piece. But we think of Bitcoin as being also kind of a computing revolution. And so a lot of things are going to change out of this.
So you mentioned, you kind of brought us up to the Bitcoin moment. What was your red pill moment? And, who were some of the Bitcoiners that helped you get up to speed on what's happening?
Yeah, I would say that there wasn't kind of a singular red pill moment for me. I found the white paper. This was in around 2012, middle of 2012. And I went through kind of a couple waves of learning about it, initially investing and thinking about it. And, again, from a philosophical standpoint, I did a lot of reading. I was already reading, a lot of philosophy papers through school. And one of the notable things about philosophy papers is that they're frequently very short and succinct, right? They make their point. There's no additional fluff. And same thing with most academic papers. So that was one of the beautiful things about when I encountered the white paper the first time. And it was just kind of directly reading that and thinking about it as a core material. I was impressed not just with the system design and with the architecture and with the kind of theses that were being drawn out and that it was working. I was also really impressed with how it was presented, right? It was kind of a revolution on multiple fronts for me. And that it just felt so succinct and forward. And then I ended up connecting. I was kind of just quiet and on forums and other, not really connected with people in the real world. And then I connected with Matt Carollo, who was at the time was at UNC, which was 15 miles away. And we put this Bitcoin event at Duke, this little Bitcoin conference. And we were trying to educate other people and try to get more people involved and trying to kind of create a meet space, like real space community around it, because most of the people that I was engaging with at the time were through 2013 were just online. And so it kind of came in waves for me. It was like the initial breakthrough, the initial thinking, the initial understanding, and then several more waves through 2013, writing some of the waves and crashes that we went through. And then into 2014, meeting Matt, who worked as a core contributor and just having a ton of conversations with him, and just kind of continuing to get deeper and deeper and deeper the whole way along. And I remember sitting, I've evaluated and seen, like, I remember sitting there at the Ethereum pre-sale and not buying in and not my core thought around Ethereum is there was like a weird thought around from an investing perspective versus a philosophical perspective. And this will be like probably a controversial statement. But I do believe that like there are, we can re-architect a lot of applications in new ways and more distributed ways. And so the kind of spirit of Ethereum of saying, hey, we want to be able to architect apps in this more distributed way. Like I thought that was really cool. But from an investment perspective, at the time, I remember thinking like, well, you know, if it's not, it should be possible for Ethereum to operate at, you know, it should be possible for Ether to be at like $1 or $2 or 50 cents in the system to still operate. Like it's not, there's not a hard cap. There's not a security model that requires the price to be very high. So it'll probably be a bad investment. Right. Yeah. And I remember, you know, again, like this was just waves kind of through, and you ask about red pill moments. There wasn't any singular one, but I was trying to kind of come at these, the kind of questions that were being raised from first principles view, from like really thinking through the kind of core pitches, and not just from kind of who was building what or who was what the flashy pieces around this were. And I was just very lucky to run into a lot of different people along the way, and have had a lot of fortunate experiences to understand all this stuff from multiple angles.
Yeah, it definitely seems like the rabbit hole is sort of endless, and we're all just, you know, getting red-pilled over and over again. And I think it's just going to continue that way, you know, for the next decade or two as this thing kind of grows up and matures into whatever the hell it's going to become, you know?
Yeah, totally. I agree with that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's going to be several decades worth of, I don't think that most people have a full grasp on most people already don't have a full grasp on how fundamental capitalism is to the kind of organization or structure of our civilization, much less a view as to how Bitcoin would affect that core position. And so I think that to really get at what the impact will be, you have to start getting at where things already are with just kind of dependence on capitalism and growth position we're already in. And so there are going to be waves of this stuff. And they're going to be, you know, we've already seen, it's happened much faster than I thought it would in terms of kind of broader awareness, especially amongst government and amongst some of the bigger players in the world.
Yeah.
But especially during some of the crises that are bound to happen the next few years, we're going to see these like, you know, waves of understanding happen. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be an interesting ride.
Yeah, absolutely. It has been already, and it's just fun to be aboard and part of it and watch it all happen. Like it's fun to get up every day now that, you know, I've got Bitcoin in my life, just, you know, working on it more and more, spending more and more time on it, taking up more of my brain cycles. And it's kind of amazing how it just gets into your mind and does its thing and just incentivizes its, you know, its own growth so beautifully.
Totally.
Yeah. All right. Let's get back to Casa for a bit. You know, the products and services are amazing, but the reason that I insta ordered that Casa One node and the gold service as soon as it, you know, came out on Twitter, is the team that you've built around you. You know, Jameson Lopp, Elena Vernova, Kelly Lyons, Nick Newman, Brian Lockhart on product. And I think your designers deserve a particular shout out. They're amazing. Scott Huge, Herf
yeah,
and Derek,
yeah, for sure.
Derek Huey, they're just rocking it out, man. Beautiful stuff. So can you talk a bit about how you approached building the team at Casa? Like what about your pitch resonated with some of the best people in the business?
Again, all those people, I'm very fortunate to be able to learn from these people and the many, many other engineers and operations team and everybody. I'm very, very fortunate to kind of work with and support and learn from these folks. But the way, you know, we when you're building a company, you have these kind of core functions and you also have like very specialized functions. And it's always kind of an art more than a science in terms of how you build up a team. Some of it is luck and opportunity. Some of it is persistence. Some of it is, you know, you have a specific need, but the way that you shape that need, like sometimes one person can kind of fill two needs. Sometimes one person can only mm-hmm. fill one need, but they do it so deeply that it's just like an absolute fit. And so each person that has joined the team has been very different in terms of how they joined the team. You know, the core pitch has always stayed the same in terms of our long-term pitch.
Yeah.
But each person has definitely been very different. And so like, you know, I've known there's some people. So Scott Herf, for instance, our head of design, who's one of the best designers in the world. It's crazy that we are able to work with him. But he's been a friend of mine for a long time, for over a decade. And we just jammed on product and, you know, we always catch up. several times a year. And he just so happened to be kind of shifting out of one role. And around the time that we were looking for design, and I was particularly passionate about, I think that this, that core private key management in the applications built around private keys and private keys as identifiers and as login, et cetera, are, you know, represents this new opportunity that will really drive the next 20, 30, 40, 50 plus years of the internet and of software, right? And so I kind of presented it to him that way. As you know, you're going to be on the ground the first, which is both kind of scary, but also a real challenge and really exciting for designers to be able to bring the core process and principles that they already have into these new areas that just need a lot of help. It's like you know, you're a medic and you're getting thrown right into a war zone, effectively, right? Like there's going to be no shortage of people who are into the emergency room. There's going to be no shortage of opportunities to practice your trade and apply, but it will also be very intense. And so, you know, he knew Derek and he brought it to him, and we've had a phenomenal time with them. You know, Jameson was slightly different too. We needed someone that was going to be a mix of back end, server side security. I knew of Jameson. We both lived in for a little while in Raleigh, Durham, but we didn't know each other at that time. And I actually reached out to him kind of cold. We both were kind of in the Carolinas. We were working part of the time in Charleston, and I was traveling a bunch in New York and San Francisco. And I knew that he was at BitGo at the time. But I kind of reached out cold. I said, look, like, you know, we're building multi-sig tools. You've been working on multi-sig for a long time on the business side. You know, I'm sure you have questions and problems and things you'd like to build on the personal side. You know, we should definitely have a discussion. And he was immediately receptive, and we it took us, you know, several months to align and just think through kind of everything we could build together. But that was another one that was like, it was kind of unique in that we had enough overlap that we were able to connect, and then but then it took us a while. You know, there was already the kind of like potential was just there, right? Like the path that we were going on was also a path that he saw benefit from improving multi-sig broadly and bringing better security broadly. And he'd been working on the institutional side, and now he brought it over to the personal side. It's just been different with everyone. But the kind of core vision has stayed the same.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about the Casa Node 2.
Sure.
I ordered mine. I'm looking forward to getting it. It's a significant hardware upgrade. The Raspi 4 is like 50% faster than the Raspi 3 on all the benchmarks. There's an SSD on the software side. There's the all new Node OS. So can you just talk about more about the functionality?
4 gigs of RAM, which is like far over the 1 gig that the first one had.
Yeah, man, that's a 4x.
Yeah, we're excited about the new Casa Node. When we first launched the Casa Node 1, I mean, it was really first of its kind, right? Like nobody was doing that. There were a few node companies, Bitcoin node companies that were out there, but kind of at a mix of the usability level, which was the goal was to be something more Apple-like that even my grandmother could set up if she wanted to. At that level, and also kind of bridging gap, and especially around Lightning experience, there really was nothing else like that. And we tested a bunch, like we do with all of the products that we build. We tested a bunch. And we made the choice around the Raspberry Pi board, Raspberry Pi 3, because you know, you're a startup, you have limited resources, you want to invest time in the things that are really going to have the highest leverage. And for us, that wasn't, you know, kind of core board level and even around the board. We actually did test some of the other faster boards, Pine 64 boards that were out at the time, but they were unreliable. They sometimes would fail. We saw a bunch of failures in our tests. And the Raspberry Pi 3 had been out a long time and had just really rock solid reliability.
Right.
But it was just a little slower.
Yep.
So we went with that one originally. And then we just knew that there was a lot of software work to be done around the experience, around the UI, around making it easy to onboard, set up, get running, to use Tor and connect from outside, to get to something like a SaaS app, right?
Yep.
Like, all of this kind of the full stack experience just wasn't possible. Nobody was doing it, but we saw it as critical to being able to explain to people, and especially kind of less hardcore Bitcoiners or more mainstream type people, on why why it was beneficial to use Casa and why it was beneficial to run a node, period. Not even if you're running Casa. And so the node blew up, and we bucketed a big chunk of them already for our major multi-sig kind of more premium customers. And then we opened some to the community and we just sold a ton of them. And so we immediately started investing more onto the node and into software. But we knew that at the time, like, there were a bunch of choices that we knew were issues. We knew, like, we got a lot of flack around the little cable that came out and reconnected.
Yeah.
But the case, I mean, the box was just, like, really clean. It was really nice. It was really easy to get into and out of. And it made it very easy, like, without having to use a screwdriver to assemble, disassemble, you know, if there were issues. And so we went with it. But it's funny, like, people kind of found fault and all these things that we already know it's an issue. Like, we wouldn't ship it if we didn't know that the issue was there, but it was a worthwhile trade-off. So yeah. The nice thing about where we are with the Casa Node 2 now is that we're finally able to kind of aggregate all these things that we already knew were issues, and that we already have thought about and been aware of, and then kind of start smoothing those out and simplifying those. And the device has always been built for people to be an early device. It's still very reckless. Lightning, period, using any kind of node is still very reckless. There are lots of kind of open questions security-wise. Routing your own transactions is going to be a thing, but it's still very early in that space too. And so we've kept that distinctly separate from the rest of the multi-sig product, which is built, the Keymaster product, which is built, you know, just for super high-end security and you know, syncing with your hardware keys and for protecting, you know, millions of dollars worth of Bitcoin.
Yeah. Do you think the node will ever be, like, able to be connected to the multi-sig wallet so that, like, you know, their transactions are being verified on your own node, et cetera? Like,
absolutely. Absolutely. That's the goal. That's the goal. Yeah. I mean, the goal is for this all to shift into a singular or a full stack platform.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
The goal is that you are able to run some of this infrastructure on your own. You know, we can help out, we can support, and you may have failover with some centralized or some cloud options. I wouldn't even call it centralized; it's just cloud, because it could even be in your local city in the cloud. But it's you know, we want to have this kind of more edge computing and cloud computing mix. And I do think, though, that having that dependency or having the ability to choose to route everything through your node is the right way to do it. The problem with that right now is that there's still a lot of issues with connectivity. Certain functions on Bitcoin, and it depends on which version of Bitcoin you run, but certain versions of Bitcoin, if you are running over RPC, there are certain security issues that come up. So connectivity to Bitcoin becomes a little bit more of an issue. We were able to actually smooth out some of that a little easier with Lightning before Bitcoin. And then there's constructing the transaction, making sure that that the full kind of construction and management of that transaction happens properly, which is all of our Keymaster side. And then when you kind of bridge the gap between that and connecting to your node, again, there's a lot that can go wrong. We also we view a lot of the external analytics platform. You know, most of the devices you have in your home, everything from phones to your TVs to, like, all these other products, even your car, they have these analytics packages that enable the end manufacturer to effectively monitor the device from anywhere. And we don't have any of that, right? So we're operating off of a function where customers reach out to us if they have a major issue. And that just makes the product development process much harder, but it also makes the security process much harder, because we have to test a lot of the edge cases well before it ever gets into a customer.
Yeah, because you guys can't really...
And so what we're...
Yeah, I mean, like, you guys can't really connect to the nodes directly. I mean, you can, but that's obviously like a last gasp kind of situation that you want to do. So you want to try to prevent that from happening at all.
Yeah. And you can view it as, like, there are all of these pitfalls that people don't see, where that we are seeing and that we're being very careful about. And it's a very narrow road to walk.
Yeah.
So, we do have this ability to where you can, like, hit a button and send logs, and they're encrypted. And you know, we can help debug off of that, but you're making an individual choice, and we still don't have like a direct connection to the device. Any usability improvements, you have to be, again, very careful with the trade-off of security too. And we've done that kind of at every level and are aware of the exact position that we've built, but it is a very, very fine line to walk. Very, very careful consideration in terms of what we're providing to customers right now and what we want to provide in the future, and kind of getting the path to get there while minimizing any, you know, risk of loss.
Yeah. So, I mean, you guys have a lot of customers who aren't necessarily super technical, but do have an advanced understanding of Bitcoin and maybe want some more advanced features like UTXO selection or like tools to help with routing payments or like, you know, maybe even running a routing node, Block Explorer powered by your own node, easy way to DCA straight to your own multisig, maybe even like mixing services, stuff like that. I mean, I know that's all like, you know, down the road kind of stuff, but what's your position on even adding or considering some of this more like advanced functionality, and trying to like balance that with the usability to, you know, spur the mass adoption that you guys are, you know, kind of the mass audience you're trying to get to?
Sure. I mean, I think that the way to think about it is that we want to enable as many apps and custom configurations as possible on the node. You can do that in one of two ways. You can do that in a way to where you build everything super custom, or you're just running, you know, existing open source software. You might make it a little bit easier to run by kind of having a wrapper around it in some capacity, but you're just running something existing and you're using the existing open source UI, and you're not adding any kind of additional functionality. And you know, that is a path to take, and that's perfectly valid. On our side, the way we think of it is we are trying to take a little bit more of an Apple style approach, in the sense of really trying to think through kind of a full stack. What are the unique things you can do? And something like StatsApp is like a perfect example of that, where you can get these unique experiences in terms of payment and it just works, right? And you don't have to think about it. And so those custom configuration options and some of the custom apps, or some of the just like, hey, let me install whichever app I want. Some of the trade-off with that is that, you know, then you have these edge cases that pop up because you have these not an infinite, but a near infinite set of possible configurations, right. Yeah. Right? So what we've tried to do with our stack is, you know, you can open the device and you can modify things anytime and you can play on the command line. But in a default state, we are creating kind of X number of options that for the more average mass market user, it's more than enough for them, but it's also like easy to use. And for someone that's not that technical, it works very well. There were already options on the market where you could just build your own node and you could use a lot of the open source tech and run that. And so the path to getting there to still offering those more advanced options while still maintaining the usability is actually a path of doing something like an SDK or like an app store. Yeah. It's not a path of just building the individual apps and just shipping them. It's actually a path of making it easier for anyone to build an app or build, you know, integration into the Casa node. And so that's part of the challenge of what we're doing is like, you know, we're operating off of significant scale. We've shipped to over 65 countries and we've shipped a lot of nodes. So we're operating off of significant scale, one, two, with like a very wide array of kind of usability and developer and kind of user experience, both technical and non. And then on top of that, like kind of multiple applications and multiple configuration options and the way to do that at scale reliably is to then have a common interfacing layer to the node. And so it's not always, you know, super custom for every single app doing very specific things. It's actually all of those apps are using a kind of common language or a common SDK or a common API layer. So that's where we're headed, is building towards that. And you will see as a result of us taking this approach, you will probably continue to see some other companies, you know, release a few features a little faster than us. But our goal is that when we do release those features, again, it just works. And you do have some of that long-term scalability that's important. And that's, again, what we recommended. You know, there's several other companies in the space, Nodal and others, that we've recommended if you want you know, some of the more custom configuration options. You can grab some of those today and they work. There are some trade-offs sometimes if things go wrong, or, you know, whether it's device failure or just configuration, and you have to, there's a lot that can go wrong as you start adding more complexity. But you're not kind of operating on those simple foundations, but some people want that. Some people want the more advanced configuration options, and they're willing to deal with the kind of setup process along the way. But our goal again is to bring the simplicity and kind of advanced functionality, but in a way that is much easier to support, much easier to scale, much easier to bring to kind of a wide audience. And doing that, we have to do that a very specific way.
Yeah, that makes good sense. And that's like really exciting to hear. I can see that. I can see the vision, and watching it unfold over the next few years is going to be really fun. On the Sats app, like, it pairs with your Lightning node. I can send and receive on Lightning with the Sats app. I've used it, you know, dozens of times at this point, maybe even 100 times. The Sats tag is really cool. I got to mention to you, because you'll get a kick out of this. The node heartbeat is like part of our family's morning now. So we get up in the morning, we're doing breakfast at the table and stuff. I set the phone on the table, and the kids, you know, they each have to do it, you know, two times. So we send two heartbeats every morning.
That's awesome.
Yeah, they love it. So they've been starting to learn more about Bitcoin because of it. And this, I don't know, it's like this sort of intangible thing that, you know, it's one of those, I guess, you know, Steve Jobs would call it like a delightful, you know, kind of user experience. It's just like a little delightful thing. So it, you know, congrats on that. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, totally. And that's a really good example. The heartbeat is a really good example of that kind of design approach, because it is something that is so subtle. It's actually fairly simple to execute, but doing it at scale and doing it in the right way, doing it in a secure way, is all very hard. Like, you know, there are probably 50 or 60 or 100 different pitfalls that you could fall into that we evaluated and didn't fall into along the way to build such a simple thing. And it seems like, you know, whenever you look at it in hindsight, it seems like one of these features, it's like, oh yeah, duh, that makes sense.
Right.
You know, it's probably, you know, code-wise, it's probably easy to implement. But I can't tell you how many hours. I mean, that, so from to give you an example of kind of concept to execution on Heartbeat. Heartbeat was an idea that I actually stumbled into and came up with probably 3 years ago. And then we built the very first. So we actually had right now we're on Casa Node V2. We launched the Casa Node last year. The year prior to that, we actually had another version that was our very first version, which we just called the Casa Computer. We didn't really release it publicly. We did a bunch of experimenting and definitely saw a bunch of people that were interested in the device, but we knew that there were some key management challenges around it, and we wanted to tackle that first and dig into that first. But around that first device, we realized that there would be these issues of uptime and needing to make sure your device was running. And it was around that time that as I was like mapping things out, I was like, oh, there'd be great if you could do this kind of regular ping. And there were a bunch of different variations on how you could do it. But at the time, we really didn't have an option. You know, Lightning wasn't, I don't even know if the Lightning paper was out. I don't think Lightning paper was out then. I don't think it was out then. So Lightning wasn't even a part of it. And then we got around, you know, two full years later, and everything is already built, right? And we were sitting there around talking about some of the different problems with the node and when you went to go do payments and the simplicity of Sats app. And we were just kind of going back and forth on like, oh man, I guess there's this uptime thing. It'd be great if there were. And as I was like, literally, or someone on the team was literally saying, oh, it'd be great if there was a way you could. I was like, holy shit, wait a second. We do have something around this, because I thought about this like 3 years ago. So I went back and found my old notes, and we got those out. And then we looked at a bunch of the, you know, tech that we had today and everything we already had built around the Casa node and Lightning. And then we came up with the solution that you see now. And we did. There were variations to where you could do it a little more automatically, but then that actually takes away some of the engagement and awareness of the user. So there's an interesting thing to where some people have said, okay, why don't you just make this automatic every day? And the reason, part of the reason for that is it's not just about doing a regular ping. It's actually about the interaction and awareness of the user to be aware, like, yeah, my node's running. I'm confident in my node. It's up. It's, the uptime is great and I don't need to check it. And if you just automate it all the time, then there's less of that awareness.
Sure.
There's also a side of even, you know, doing it in a way that was, we did it in a way that was privacy preserving, and that actually took us a while to do it over Tor. And there are ways to do it so it's actually a little more invasive and could potentially do more, but there's just a lot of nuance there. So I just think that's a good, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. There's just a lot packed into it. It seems like such a simple feature, but it is something it's very hard to build. It took, you know, over 2 years to come to fruition. And, you know, towards the end of that build out, it was a full team. Like everybody had, you know, kind of pieces of ideas and problems they were solving leading up to that. And it was a full team effort to get it that simple. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping to do that. We want to do that with the ability to build on top of Casa Node. We want to do that with other types of applications. We're just, you know, Casa ultimately is a security and privacy company. And the way we've, you know, set up the business model is it's around, like, you do kind of pay a flat yearly fee and we just give you this toolkit. And then we want to build more experiences in that, you know, similar to the node, similar to the heartbeats, to make security an easier and more engaged process for, you know, for people globally.
Yeah, man. So what is the future for SatsUp? Like, what do you, if you can, you know, divulge any, you know, whatever generalities or anything, like what else are you guys going to do with it in the coming years?
I think SatsUp is, you know, you can think of it as a little bit more of the same, but also a little bit of expansion in the sense that, you know, a lot of the, you know, one approach around design is that you actually want to kind of use the same toolkit and same narrow focus, and just do more things with it. But you don't, what you got to be really careful not to like bolt on some, you end up with this kind of, Frankenstein if you just start bolting on random features. So
yeah,
we think of SatsUp, the focus of the app is supposed to be super simple, you know, Bitcoin payments and earning. And so you can earn Sats back. You can do that in a couple of different ways, mostly around the node, connecting the node, running regular heartbeats. We do have some other ideas for stuff we want to do in terms of earning Sats back. And so we are working on some different options for that. You know, we've talked about whether we wanted to embed Neutrino and make it easier to run Lightning even if you didn't have a full node. We're not really going down that path yet, but that is an option. Right now, you can download it. And if you don't have a node, you just run a regular Bitcoin wallet, but it's still non-custodial. There's a lot. There's other integrations with other liquidity services that we can make it easier to just, you know, manage your node and also have, you know, any liquidity questions. We don't want to provide any liquidity services ourselves, but we would make it easier to plug into some of these other companies that are working on problems around that. So you know, you're talking about adding more features around managing the node and managing Lightning and managing Bitcoin, and then also kind of more ways to earn and more experiences around that while also keeping it just pretty narrowly focused and tight around the simplified experience. And then we're trying to embed more and more on the more complicated in-depth experience, kind of at the key master level and getting into multisig.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. Let's talk about multisig a little bit more. Like today, my app just updated. And so I've got the option to migrate my mobile key over to a second hardware wallet, which is cool. I'm definitely going to be taking advantage of that. What have you like heard from customers about their experience with multisig? I mean, mine has been great. It's been super easy. Have people who, you know, aren't maybe as technical or whatever, like gotten back to you and, you know, reported great user experiences? And maybe what are some of like the, you know, maybe suggestions for improvements that you've been hearing?
Sure. So a lot of people, first off, just a lot of people don't understand the full purpose of multisig or the reason why it's important. And so
yeah. We
have had to do some education around that. Jamison Lopp just recently posted an overview of Shamir's secret sharing and why, and a lot of the pitfalls around that. similar to the Heartbeat cost node. And, you know, we've evaluated just about everything in the space. And there's a lot of different combinations of Shamirs that, you know, people have tried to use. There's even different combinations of multi-sig with Shamirs. There's different kinds of models around, the different kind of models around, you know, do you yourself manage all of your keys? Do you give a key to a family member? Do you give keys to other business partners? Do you have an outside company or an outside lawyer manage a key and then you manage keys? And we evaluated a lot of different options before settling on where we are now. And we did bake that into a report called the Wealth Security Protocol. We're lucky to have another fantastic person in this space, Jacob Lyles, who wrote the Glacier Protocol, which is one of the oldest multi-sig standards and multi-sig protocols. Way back, and a lot of early exchanges actually used their model to do their early cold storage. Jacob joined the team about a year ago and worked with us to help us build out a really clear documentation around the model that we built, and that's in this Wealth Security Protocol. So it outlines the 13 different threats against your Bitcoin and how multi-sig mitigates those and all the different design choices we made and all the design choices we didn't make, in a sense of the things that we decided not to do and why. So I just outlined that because there's a lot that we can cover here in this question. Yeah. And there is a full document. It's about a 40-page document that covers a lot of this, that I would encourage everybody. If you just type Wealth Security Protocol or Casa Wealth Security Protocol in Google, you'll see it. And it is, you can download, I think on our website, I think it requires an email, but you can go to GitHub and get the full PDF, and we have it, it's up, you can grab it. So there's a lot to dig in there. And then, but in terms of the feedback that we've received, a lot of it has been very positive. A lot of people excited to finally have security options. Again, similar to the Heartbeat, similar to the node, we didn't want to ship something that we didn't think was at a security level. And for us, we only make money if people are secure and happy and, have money to continue buying from us, right? We don't have any other business model mixed in. We're not making money off of trades. We're not making money off of other types of financial products or anything. And I think that there is something really important around that. And so we've made very specific choices. And so we have gotten feedback from customers that they'd like, the two hardware wallets was a very clear one. And so we worked to get that out. We also have been working on cold card support, partially on Bitcoin transactions. So that is coming. That's been a big request. We do have more coming in the new year, and we're building easier and easier access. And I think what we've seen too is that we've seen people that start with the basic 2 of 3 multisig, and then very clearly see why multisig is important, and then they say, "Hey, I actually want to upgrade and get 4, 3 of 5, because I understand why that extra amount of security and why all this is kind of balanced the way it is." So we're seeing that too. But it's again, if you have questions around multisig and around the threats, that document is there. We cover a ton of stuff there. You can always email me or message me too, or ask on Twitter. We're always happy to discuss this stuff, but there's just a very deep well on all of these stuff.
Yeah, I've reviewed that document and it is super impressive. And I'll link to it in the show notes too, so you can just be a click away and check it out. I definitely recommend all the listeners to take a look at that, because even if you're not a Casa customer or even considering being a Casa customer right now, that is an amazing overview of why you should be using multisig,
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And that's the important thing, is it's we're really trying to get into just kind of core threats and why we chose this out of anything else. There are lots of other options that could be used security wise, but we chose all this stuff for very, very, very specific reasons. There are other options out there, and there's, you do have Glacier Protocol, which is one of the oldest. You can just use even Electrum. And we actually do recommend, so as a backup option, we do have several options when you're using our service. We have several options on how you can recover your funds, even if we're not there. And so we do recommend some of these other open source tools, but people could use those even if they didn't want to use us. It's just by using us, you get a little bit of added protection in terms of the way the user interface is built, the multi-platform support. That, again, there are certain threats that helps protect you against.
Yeah. I mean, there's another new product that we should talk about. You guys are just dropping them left and right. Covenant, which is definitely related to multi-sig. It's a new cost of service to make Bitcoin inheritance easier. So yeah, tell us about Covenant and what, you know, how does Covenant kind of stand out compared to what's available out there for Bitcoin inheritance?
Yeah, so Covenant is really first of its kind around longer term considerations of inheritance. And it's really an extension of the existing multi-sig product. So, you know, we view multi-sig as being, as more and more of it is standardized and people are used to kind of swapping out keys and using different key types, more things will be built into this, more functions will be found for it. You know, you could have a multi-sig key set that's somehow tied to the deed of a building or something. I mean, there's like a lot that can be done in terms of just using cryptographic signatures. But one of the most near-term other solutions, you know, you have to start at the side of just, okay, I'm just protecting and holding and my funds, right? I'm just hodling. And that's kind of problem set one. And then I need to be able to transfer easily and I need to be able to recover easily. Like those are all kind of problem number one. And then once you have that and once you can protect yourself over the course of years or months or decades, then you eventually get to this problem of inheritance of, okay, if something bad happens, how do I continue my usage of those funds or make sure those funds get to the people that I want them to? And so that is then a related but slightly separate problem. And the big challenge, the biggest challenge with inheritance, is that there are, you know, really even more pitfalls around inheritance than there are around just kind of singular storage for yourself. And the reason for that is that, you know, it's similar to people will talk about how like a prediction market can eventually turn into an assassination market, right? Because if you start using prediction markets and thinking about, the odds of different events happening, eventually, you know, it can become an assassination market. There are these perverse incentives that if you set up an inheritance program wrong, it actually can create incentive to off somebody, right?
Sure.
It can create an incentive to where certain people are aware of your setup enough that they then have incentive because the resources on the line are large enough that it could incentivize someone to actually, take you out. And that's a terrifying thought. And there are a lot of other considerations like that that we've just been modeling out and thinking through and threats. And so the balances you have to strike is that you want, on the one hand, you want to protect the person. You want to make it transferable at the right time, but not before. And you don't want to create these negative incentives that could cause, you know, any one actor to try to take action against that end user. And there's a very, 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 all of this is just logic. There's a very, very small subset of solutions that kind of meet all those requirements. And so that's also something that Jacob has been working on for us. And we just announced the service, and you know, it is one thing that we arrived at is that the trade-off between using a 3 of 5 and a 3 of 6, 3 of 6 allows you to just have an extra key that goes to a lawyer, inheritance lawyer. We do think that that's actually an important part of it right now. There are lots of, you know, when family members get involved, it's easy to think, oh, I'll just hand several of these to my family members or friends, and then they can help with the transfer. But it is. Again, you get into these situations to where you could cause a rift or could cause someone to try to attack you that you just didn't even anticipate, because so much in terms of resources could be on the line.
Yeah. And families are just complicated too.
Yeah. Families are already complicated already. It's another thing. I mean, how many movies do you need to watch to where there's some, you know, big, inheritance on the line and then everybody's at each other's throats. Right. And
exactly.
Then somebody killed somebody or somebody did this dastardly thing and sabotaged somebody. You know, there's tons of movies on this, and as the price of Bitcoin rises, there's going to be probably many more movies on this.
Yeah.
and we're trying to minimize the number of movies or stories that ever get written, just because I think that again, you have to strike that balance between making it accessible, but not creating new risks.
Yeah.
And so that's what we've done with Covenant, and we're releasing more details. We've already started pilots with some customers, but it's been a 9 or 10 month process and mapping out all of these different risks and making it accessible, making it secure, making it, you know, easy to protect users, but also not opening up new threats.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, I'm super convicted about Bitcoin at this point, and there's like really very few things that concern or worry me, but the physical threats, you know, potential physical threats of, you know, that potential consequence of holding your own Bitcoin, of having a bearer asset, is, you know, it's scary. I mean, we are far removed from an age where people were holding, you know, their own wealth themselves and had the right. Had to take the personal responsibility to protect and defend that. You know, yeah. So it's a whole different world. There's so many more ways to, you know, attack somebody. I know Jameson has been through this personally and, you know, put forth like tons and tons of just effort and time to try to reclaim some of his privacy and protect his family. Right. So yeah, I mean, that really worries me a lot. And I think, do you think that that's going to affect Bitcoin adoption, like negatively enough where like it could really, you know, maybe even prevent Bitcoin from becoming, you know, global money, like, or to some extent anyway? How worried do you think people are going to be about this stuff? And how worried are you about this kind of shit going down? How can like Casa Multisig, like how does it help mitigate that stuff?
I think that the challenge around it, and this kind of brings us back to these questions of civilizational change.
Yeah.
We have seen these, and they're effectively just like phase shifts. It's like going, you know, having a material that goes from solid to liquid to gas, right? You have these kind of phase shifts that are going to happen, that have happened historically. We haven't seen one in a long time, mm-hmm. but they do happen. And I think that Bitcoin does represent something in terms of a next phase shift. And so there will always be trade-offs with using Bitcoin. There will always be security trade-offs, but there will always be like power trade-offs too. And if you look at the kind of billionaires of our day, most of them have personal security. Most of them have layers upon layers of security in terms of the way their assets are set up.
Yeah.
Most of them have layers of security in terms of the way their corporations are set up. Most of them have had, you know, most of them that survive have had at least a few attacks in some capacity. It might be a child or a pet or someone else that was kidnapped. It might be a kind of corporate raid or takeover.
That's the worst nightmare right there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, there's a lot. And what this just comes down to, what I'm getting at, is that anytime you have something valuable, a certain portion of the population is going to want to take it from you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a reality of what we face. And I think that we try to be very careful around our community of just making people aware of those risks, of the realities of those risks. But it is a very real thing. And so I think that what we're seeing is, like, you know, the weird thing about technology is that what technology makes possible is that it can take both benefits and problems of a very narrow set and actually bring them to most everybody. So, you know, we used to be in a world where, in terms of food, you basically ate what was in front of you. You never had many options or choices. And, you know, the majority of the population basically just worked a physical job and ate what was available to them. And that was it. And it was only the kind of small, wealthy few that had choice of all these different options and could even get really fat, right? Or get obese. And now we've had, because of technology, because of food technology, because of the ability for us to produce a lot, now, you know, people all over the world, not in every country, but in many different countries, now we have this much bigger issue of people having to make choices around the food that they eat, where you go back a century and this wasn't even really a choice.
Yeah.
So we're going to see other cases of this, to where, you know, right now these major security issues or major wealth issues are just the realm of billionaires, and not even really 10 or 20 of millionaires. It's like billionaires. And then it's going to shift to a point to where, because of the power that's afforded to you by having this much wealth or this much power around your own assets, it does become, some of those concerns become more widespread.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, yeah, it's some, definitely something I worry about from time to time. I get anxious about it and thinking about it. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why I've got, you know, my Bitcoin locked up in Casa Multisig and my hardware wallets are out of the house, you know? And yeah, I just, yeah, it's another reason why, I mean, obviously like me being a public figure, in Bitcoin is also something. I mean, we're all out here kind of on the front lines, the entrepreneurs, the content creators, the educators, and then, you know, that right. kind of opening ourselves up, to that. I mean, we need people to do that, to make this thing happen. But I totally get the, you know, stay pseudonymous and keep your private, like stay as private as you possibly can. Because, you know, once you're out, it's super hard, as Jameson has made clear in many, like several presentations he's made, like it's super hard to take that back once you're out.
Yeah. And I will say that it's like, it's not going to be sustainable to stay fully hidden forever. I think that there will be parts of our lives that we'll be able to hide for a long time, but you have to assume that even if you do every possible thing to go entirely off the grid, that you will have, you know, some layers of breaches or some layers of, you know, awareness. And it could come down to, like, maybe it's not a broad public awareness, but maybe there are other people you work with, right? Or maybe there are other family members, there are other friends. You know, there are layers to this. And I think that, that, you know, we don't want to live in a world to where the only protection you have is just by being a total ghost.
Yeah.
We do think that it's smart for people to be aware of their privacy and to increase their privacy. And we've been thinking about even about tools that we could even provide to help people not just secure their Bitcoin, but almost secure their privacy data and think about like all their data and think about increasing their privacy. Right. We've been thinking some about that. And so I think that, but the approach there is that you should have a range of options to where right now it's just like black or white, and we think that, you know, in the case to where you did want to lead still a somewhat more public life, you should still have some security options, and multisig is one of those things that kind of gives you superpowers by the incentives that are built around it, just mean that you have a, you know, much higher barrier of protection.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to ask you about this. There are recently some criticisms leveled on Twitter, and about security vulnerabilities with the Casa node. And
sure.
I heard Nick Szabo mention the discussion even on What Bitcoin Did last week.
Right.
Can you walk us through these criticisms and Casa's response to them, and maybe talk more generally about how Casa makes decisions about the trade-offs between complexity and security?
Yeah, this is a great point. And we are always happy to, you know, address all this stuff publicly. And we encourage people to always raise questions and raise issues. In this particular case, we kind of had a situation to where someone that raised totally false statements before, has lied about us before, had kind of raised another issue that we were aware of and that we've talked to customers about and that, you know, the broader population was aware of. And this is all not new stuff to Casa customers, but it got blown out of proportion and got blown into, you know, people bringing up things that, again, you know, this was a public discussion. We'd had it before, and a lot of false statements floating around. So I'll kind of like bucket it into kind of the basics of what happened and the choices that we made. And then this kind of secondary discussion in terms of the trade-offs of really security and usability. And so the first side on actually kind of the questions of what happened is there's a case to where a Casa node right now doesn't run on HTTPS. So if you're on your local network, it doesn't run on HTTPS. And we all were aware of whenever we put that out. I mean, it was a very conscious decision. And the way to solve that, to run it on HTTPS, is by, you know, if you're running a local device, you have to do what's called a self-signed certificate. That self-signed certificate is a whole can of worms. It actually can create, we had several people point this out publicly, or several people point this out kind of in the chain of conversation. We were not the only ones to point this out, but that doing self-signed certificates opens a whole can of worms and can actually create a false sense of security. Because if it's done improperly, you can end up in this case to where, you know, you think that everything's secure, you think everything's working, but you could still have a breach. So, and you also don't want users to get used to or thinking that they are totally secure, right? To where if there was a self-signed certificate, there was still potential of a breach, but it just appears to them that there is no risk, then they actually get more comfortable than they need to be. Where we have always, especially around the Casa Node product, we have always represented this publicly that it is still a very early stage product. People should only put on, you know, Lightning is very early stage. Bitcoin still is very early stage. You know, the Casa Node itself, like all this stuff is still very risky. And so that's a very different consideration from our Keymaster product, to where there's been a lot more on the testing side, and then also just on the security side, they're just built for very different purposes. And so we made this choice. We said, look, like we're going to use HTTP. We're going to stick with that. We will make customers aware of the trade-offs and of the issues and the discussion. And we were very transparent of that. You know, right when we had people asking about this right when the device came out over a year ago, and we talked about it all publicly then. So again, all of this got blown out of proportion. Wasn't anything new. And where this got back to is that it's just this discussion of kind of usability and security. And what it comes down to is that you're always having to make choices or make options for an end user. And you have some users that want to dig down into the technical nitty gritty and make the and use, I would say, features or use options that they want to customize down to the finest detail. But the majority of people don't have time to go through all of that. So
yeah, that's why they become a Casa customer, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, but our job is to provide a secure enough option while also making the customer very clearly aware of their risk. And that's exactly what we've done. We've done that from day one. We've made the customer very clearly aware of the risks. And we've also been very transparent around our design decisions and why we made them. And we've been very, you know, we've been very careful in the decisions that we made there. Because we don't want customers to shoot themselves in the foot. We also don't want them to expose themselves to kind of new types of issues. And so, you know, if you want to get down to saying, okay, well, what's the absolute most secure computer. The most secure computer out there is one that does not have a power cable, that is buried underground in a cement box that is not even used, right? Like that's the most secure computer. And in any other scenario, you're going to be in a case to where there are going to be attackers. It's just going to be trade-offs in terms of where those attackers are, where they can come in, how they're going to access your device. And so we settled down to this case of, okay, like whenever you're within your home network, you do need to be aware of what's on that network. But ultimately, you know, even most home routers are actually configured very similar to the way that we configured our device. So we didn't think it was anything new, because most home routers are also in a similar case around this kind of HTTPS, HTTP issue. But we also, you know, we are thinking of improvements, and we launched Tor, and we are thinking of ways that you could actually do kind of more of your setup and more of your controls, and we already allow you to fully control everything over Tor, and that would solve some of these issues. It's just not an easy solution, because then you open up, you know, if you want the customer to do self-signed certificates, you end up in a case to where they're going to have to do, you know, way more configuration than many of them signed up to do, and in some cases, even command line work, right? And so there is this balance. There's this balance of strike, and we've been very public about that. We will continue to be very public about that. And the important thing around this, though, again, is that we're always public about these conversations, and that we continue to be, and I think that that's kind of where we were. So we were kind of surprised that it blew up, because again, it was a conversation that we'd already had with our customers, and most of our customers were like messaging us privately saying, hey, like, this is the same question we already discussed. And we're like, yeah, we already discussed this. So that was why there was a little bit of delay even in response from us. It's because we were like, why is this even coming up? This is, you know, some of these are false statements. Some of these are true, but they're aware, you know, we're aware of the issue. So it's just an odd thing.
All right, cool. That's great. I mean, I'm glad that we had a chance to address that. And, you know, it's been out there. So, I didn't want to publish this episode without, you know, at least talking about it.
Oh, of course. But, and again, we're always very public, very transparent, very open to discussing any of these questions and issues from customers. We always try to make customers aware of the calculated risks that they are making. And we do this across all of our products. I mean, we walk through customers in terms of on both Keymaster. There are very different security models from Keymaster to the Casa node. There are always improvements that we can make, and we do those. And we are always, you know, the first ones to message customers if there is a real issue. And there was actually a real issue around Lightning and an update to Lightning just a few months ago, right? And we were very quick to message customers, make sure that they were aware of the issue, make sure they were aware that they needed to upgrade. We provided the upgrade. And so we will always continue to do that.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about Lightning just in general. I know, you know, Casa is obviously building heavily on Lightning. There's just so much happening so fast. A couple episodes ago, Keto Miner mentioned to us that after the Berlin Lightning conference, he was just absolutely stoked. And there's a lot of exciting work kind of happening behind the scenes right now. What are you excited about on Lightning? What do you see happening in the next year or two?
I mean, I'm excited broadly about Lightning. There's still a ton of problems to solve, both around liquidity, around onboarding, around actual use cases and functions. There's a lot to do, and we obviously are supporting where we can. We also have a ton to just support more broadly around privacy and security generally. Lightning is a part of that, but I would just say that I don't think that Lightning is going to be just a 1 or 2 year and then everything's going to work and everybody's going to be on Lightning. I mean, I think it's going to be several years before it really builds up, but we will have several significant improvements in just the next year or two, again, around the problems around liquidity, around the simplicity of opening up both inbound and outbound channels, around just getting started with Lightning and doing it all in a non-custodial way. I think that's also important. Even the kind of SPV way around Neutrino, I think is fine in temporary cases, but I think it's dangerous to build over dependence there. And so you want to kind of use this spectrum and then lean towards the most security or get to the most secure option you can kind of as soon as possible. But there are also like a bunch of important privacy improvements that come from using Lightning regularly. And so all of those are good things, but it will take, I think, a few years for us to really see the massive improvements that are going to be, you know, getting us to tens of millions of users.
Yeah, totally agree. You guys are, Casa's supported by or invested, Boost VC is invested in Casa, one of your VC investors. I saw you tweet about them, and so I took a look. They seem like to be like a super unique VC firm. Their thesis on their website is sci-fi technology. That's what they invest in. Their call to action is like, if you're building an incredible superpower, contact us for an investment, which I love. So can you talk a little bit more about Boost VC and like talk about what it's been like to be a part of that kind of ecosystem of these, you know, super forward looking sci-fi type companies?
Sure. So Brayton, Adam, Maddie, the rest of the team there are all awesome. Would highly encourage anybody to apply there. That if they have, you know, they think in big ideas, right? And we approach them with the big idea of even launching nodes and doing kind of major premium key management. Nobody was doing this stuff, and they got it pretty quick, understood the need, and backed us. And we were very thrilled to be able to work with them. Adam's dad is also a big Bitcoin believer, Mr. Draper, and has been kind of long in the space. And so they are big Bitcoin bulls and have thought long and hard about the space and have been around the space. And I think we're the first kind of accelerator, major investor kind of early stage around Bitcoin. They were very public about it. And so they've kind of been around the space for a long time and just thrilled to work with them. We have a great set of investors across the board. We have Lair Hippo who Lair Hippo has long been in. They're in New York City, and they led our seed round, and they've been in a bunch of kind of direct to consumer brands and also kind of more premium brands, everything from like your Casper mattresses, Allbirds shoes, a bunch of different brand. They really understand branding, and they really understand kind of core consumer quality products. And that's a very different offering from super technical companies. And so they bring a lens to us that we just get a really good feedback perspective from them. It's different from Boost VC, and it's, you know, valuable in a much different way. But Julian over there and Eric Hippo, and their entire team, it's been phenomenal working with them. We've also had Compound VC, which Josh Nussbaum, who they've done a bunch of Bitcoin related investments and are big bulls. And then Charles Hudson was another one of our early backers, really before anybody. He was the first kind of institutional, and he does a lot of pre-seed rounds. And he is there in San Francisco, Melton Demirers, Elise Colleen, the Castle Island guys, who Matt and Nick. We've got a great group of investors, and there are just many that I'm leaving off in terms of angels and in terms of funds. But phenomenal group, and everybody. It's been very encouraging for me to see see the number of people that are thinking this far about the future, and they grapple with the real questions too. I mean, it's not just, they're not viewing us as, hey, you know, let's just build another kind of large cash churning company. You know, they get it. They get it that this is kind of civilization changing stuff, and that the implications are high. And so are very careful and thoughtful about their analysis. And we appreciate that, because there are other firms out there that have not been that way and have been a little bit more careless. And so we've been very, very lucky to be working with some great investors.
That's awesome, man. I'm mindful that you have to head out soon. So I'd like to just hear a bit about, I know you kind of like to nerd out on some of this future tech stuff, and like cybernetics and biohacking. I recently watched that Unnatural Selection series on Netflix about biohacking. It was kind of blowing my mind. So just like give us a taste of like your sort of like, you know, future daydreams of the future. Like what's it going to be like? How does Bitcoin fit into all of that too?
Yeah, so I think of the future is actually like way more in our control than most people think.
Yeah,
and I think like the best lesson that I can give people, or the best kind of realization that I've had around that, is that the future is just, it's way more in your control than you think, and the future is created. It's not just kind of set in stone. And from that perspective, you know, thinking hard about the future and about where we want it to go is actually really important. And so what cybernetics actually refers to is just control systems or control loop systems. And the easiest example is an AC unit in a house, where you have a thermometer or a temperature gauge that just checks the temperature and then turns on or turns off a heater or a cooler based on the temperature. So if you're in the middle of winter, and you know, you've got it set to be 65 or 70, then, and the temperature in the house drops below, it drops to, you know, 64, and the heater is going to turn on, and it's going to get it back to 65, and then it's going to turn off. Right. And there's a circle there. There's a cycle to where basically, you know, the temperature checks. If it's not hot enough, it turns on, it gets hot enough and it turns off, and it checks again, and then it turns on, then turns off. And it just kind of goes through that loop, that control loop, over and over and over again. And so I think that thinking about cybernetics is like, we're going through thousands of these like cycles in our everyday lives. So you can think of that whenever you plug the phone in the evening, right, before you go to bed, and you charge the phone, and then you wake up and it's fully charged. Even you can simplify cybernetics down to like even just climbing into a bed and then onto a mattress to sleep, right, in a specific room every night is like, that's a cybernetic process in a sense, because it's like you're going to a specific piece of technology, a bed, a mattress that is designed specifically for sleep to give you this ideal type of sleep, and you're waking up at a later point, and then you do it every single day, every single night, right? So it is a loop. Right, it's a loop in a sense. And I think that the thing that I would encourage people to think about, and the thing that I think about a lot, is how do we make better loops in a sense? How do we make better process? How do we make the world and our kind of day-to-day lives better? It is easy to get distracted with this kind of fully future-facing picture that is never connected to reality and is going to be really hard to get to. And so I encourage people to think of like, okay, like how can I get to this kind of future state with this future product? And how can I reach that in a very, very detailed way? And there are, you know, it may take a while, but it's possible to do. So the way we think about Bitcoin is one of these technologies that already in its existence is this kind of sci-fi technology. The fact that it's even possible for all these different players, different types of users to interact with the system in a fully distributed way to where no single user kind of has monopoly control and is changing all permissions, et cetera, is that's already kind of science. It's not even science fiction, it's science fact, right? It is remarkable that it is even possible. And now we need to think of other ways that other systems can also change to kind of build dependence on that or make use of the fact that it exists. And so in thinking in terms of cybernetics and in terms of designing the future is things like, you know, multi-sig. Like we as a company, we kind of took this position that we had all these companies, all these people telling us, hey, multi-sig is like not going to be viable. Nobody's going to use this. It's too hard. Everybody's just going to go use centralized custodians. We feel like that's like saying, hey, don't ever use Bitcoin. Just use the US dollar. You know, the US dollar is much easier for people to access. It's already in their wallets. Like, don't even touch Bitcoin. I mean, it's like a similar argument. It's like it's a little more challenging, but the way that it becomes you get to the point, there was a point when the first US dollars were printed that they weren't widespread and there were other dominant currencies in the world. And so if you don't see a path forward, you can't get to that future to where it's a better state. And we genuinely believe that Bitcoin is not only better money, it's actually a better computing and better kind of approach to systems design. And that's what's important. And we need to think about how to take social networks and how to take productivity applications and how to take, you know, general computing, how to take our cars and how to take like all these other systems that are out there that are so heavily dependent on centralized control. We need to think of ways to kind of break those free. And so that's just where I would position it in terms of thinking about the future, thinking about cybernetics. You know, think about a better future for yourself and your family and your kids, and think about ways that you can make that future a reality. Don't get so caught up. It's great to have long-term plans, but don't get so caught up in fantasies that will take, you know, that you won't even be able to achieve in your lifetime. But do think about the science fiction futures that you can, you know, within a few years or within even decades, right? But with enough distinct steps that you could actually get to.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think Bitcoin is making the achievement of those goals and dreams, you know, just way more possible. Having those resources available, the follow-on effects of sound money that I've talked a lot on this podcast about, you know, enable that, all that stuff to happen. So it's kind of an amazing future that we're looking forward to. And, you know, I call this the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance, and it's amazing to be here.
Yep. I think that's it. So
that's it. Awesome. All right, man.
Well, thanks for having me on.
This was a ton of fun. Really appreciate it. Is there anything though you want to end with, let listeners know about?
You know, not much. I mean, you can go to keys.casa to check out more about Casa's offerings. We do offer a security and privacy subscription, which includes kind of the full toolkit that you'll need with both multi-sig and the Casa node at different levels. We offer multi-sig, whether you're storing, you know, a few $1,000 worth or whether you're storing millions worth, we have security solutions there to make it easier and to give you the best possible security across the board. You can email membership@team.casa and we're happy to go through and do kind of full demos of products. You can also just download Keymaster, Sats app, and order a Casa node. And kind of have the full experience. But let me know if you have questions. I'm just Jeremy@team.casa, or I'm Jeremy R. Welch on Twitter. And then we're Casa Hodl on Twitter as well. But, you know, feel free to reach out if you've got any other questions. And again, thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Jeremy. Take care, man. Keep up the great work.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks. All right. Thanks to Jeremy for his time and to you for listening. I always love to hear your thoughts, questions, feedback, painful criticisms if you have them. Tweet whatever is on your mind. You can tag me at Citizen Bitcoin. Jeremy is at Jeremy R. Welch. That's JeremyRWelch. You can support the podcast by sharing it on Bitcoin Twitter or with your family and friends. Send them some Bitcoin and some Bitcoin education with Give Bitcoin and tell them to subscribe to the Citizen Bitcoin podcast, and together we'll help you turn them into wizened hodlers. This week's open source shout out is LND. LND is the leading Lightning protocol implementation powering most of the Lightning apps out there. Shout out to Roast Beef and Connor leading the work on that project, but there are 201 contributors to this open source project at this point. You can support the project by running betas, providing feedback and code on the project's GitHub. All right, that's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.